Good morning. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV. I'm Rick Singeri. This is actually an encore edition of Vermont Viewpoint. All week long, we've been bringing you some of the best interviews of the past year. Each day this week, we've focused on a different topic. So far, you've heard from musicians, authors, and business owners. Tomorrow, we'll hear from some of the WDEV All-Stars. Today, it's party time. We're going to replay some of the best interviews with those producing beers and spirits in Vermont. And please remember, these are recorded interviews, so we are not taking phone calls. Let's get this show rolling by listening back to our interview with Ryan Christensen, the president and head distiller of Caledonia Spirits. We're going to focus on Caledonia Spirits, maker of Bar Hill Gin, Tomcat Gin, and Vodka. They've received many accolades for their liquors, but none quite what you're going to hear about today. Here to tell us about the Caledonia Spirits story is president and head distiller Ryan Christensen. Good morning, Ryan.
Hey, Rick. How are you?
I'm really well. Thank you. Ryan, Caledonia Spirits started with honey and a vision. Tell us how the distillery got started.
Yeah, so we were founded by a beekeeper, a man named Todd Hardy from Northeast Kingdom. Todd is a lifelong beekeeper, and he's just both a lover of bees, but also just really passionate about keeping honey raw, the health benefits associated with raw honey. And Todd was a bit of a pioneer back in the early days of raw honey and educating the world about that. And Todd started a distillery in Hardwick. Todd got his roots in Sarasburg and then moved to Hardwick and started the distillery and wanted to bring raw honey into distillation, which is just exactly where it belongs.
What were the first things that you were making in the beginning years of Caledonia Spirits?
So like many distilleries, you know, we wanted to start with unaged products, so vodka and gin specifically. So our vodka is made from 100% raw honey, so we don't use any grain or any potatoes. We just use raw honey fermented and then distilled twice, once through a pot still, once through a column still, and then it's ready to go to market. And then our gin is a little more of a botanical expression. We're utilizing the botanicals that are living within the raw honey. So, you know, essentially what the bees have been collecting pollen from. So it's like any gin made with juniper. Juniper is by all means kind of this focal point of our gin. It's a big, piney, resinous punch. And then the raw honey brings this botanical complexity that softens that resinous character of the juniper and creates a nice balance.
That marriage of gin and honey, I mean, it seems so natural now when you have Bar Hill Gin, but back then it was innovative. So what did people think? How did you convince them that try this gin, it's going to be different decidedly, but we really think you're going to like it?
Yeah, I mean, it gets mixed responses. You know, if somebody's been drinking gin for a very long time and they're really kind of hooked on, you know, a classic dry, they might taste Bar Hill and say, this doesn't taste like the gin that I'm familiar with. More often than not, it's something that folks would say, hey, you know, I'm not going to drink this in the cocktail I'm used to. I'm going to drink this as is or, you know, on the rocks. But most of our customers, you know, we hear this all the time. Folks try Bar Hill Gin and they say, I don't even like gin, but I really like this.
Well, I do love gin, and I tried a sample at the Burlington Farmers Market, just a wee sip, and neat. Like you said, you just got it straight, and I never drank gin straight before, always in a mixed drink, usually gin and tonic. Now, I won't drink your gin adulterated with anything else, and I would imagine you must hear that an awful lot.
We definitely do, both with the gin and also with Tomcat. You know, Tomcat is our barrel-aged gin, and, you know, we aged it in a brand-new American oak barrel, which really brings in these characteristics that you find in a bourbon. And, you know, we hear that all the time. You know, folks say, and I drink it that way. You know, it tastes great, you know, on a big ice cube, maybe with citrus if you like it. But gin is absolutely worth sipping on.
Well, you bring up Tomcat, and I think I visited your distillery after you had just won an award in Hong Kong for the gin. You were about to bottle the first of this Tomcat gin, and It was dark. It didn't look like gin. So tell us more about where the heritage of that Tomcat gin comes from and the whole idea of aging a gin, which didn't seem, normal to me in these barrels.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, Tomcat, like many great products, is definitely a bit of a successful accident where, we had a very, I remember when you toured and I think when you were there, we still had the little 15-gallon direct fire still.
Yep.
And we were hard at work trying to scale up into our 300-gallon still. And that turned out to be a much harder project than we had anticipated. And it took us almost a year and a half to get the right flavor out of that still. Toward the end of that year and a half process, when we were getting really close, we were producing this fantastic gin, but we could still detect it in a blind sampling. We could still detect that it wasn't Bar Hill gin, and we couldn't put the Bar Hill label on it. Meanwhile, at the same time, we had this 500-gallon pot still that had undersized condensers, and it was something that we were still tinkering with and not working properly, and that's where we were supposed to be making bourbon, which is why we owned a bunch of empty brand new American oak barrels. And those oak barrels were going to dry up and they'd never hold liquid if we didn't get some liquid into them. And this gin was just too good to go down the drain, but we couldn't quite put the Bar Hill label on it. So as means of procrastination, I said, let's just put it in the barrel and see what happens. And within a couple of weeks in the barrel, it was just this incredible aroma. You know, it's sort of this, you get the hard, dense oak quality, meets that kind of softened juniper, and it just had this coniferous aroma that was, it was nice. So we decided, hey, let's leave in the barrel and see what happens. And, 4 to 6 months later, we started emptying these barrels, and we said, this is something we can take to market.
Oh, it is phenomenal. And I'm so glad that you, whatever, stumbled upon it, made a mistake, created Tomcat Gin, because it really is a nice compliment to the regular Bar Hill gin. How do you convince people who are gin lovers and just love your Bar Hill gin to try the Tomcat and the different flavor that they're going to be exposed to?
Yeah, there's some folks that love them both. Some folks go, is it just Bar Hill or just Tomcat? The Tomcat customer most often loves whiskey or whiskey cocktails. It's just such a, if you like, an old fashioned, if you like any of the classic bourbon or rye cocktails, it's a really easy swap. Just take out the bourbon and put in gin, and it just brings a new life to a classic cocktail, and folks really have a lot of fun with that.
And do I remember correctly that Tomcat has kind of a heritage in Great Britain, the name or the style?
Yeah, I mean, back in during the gin craze, the British Parliament banned gin. Gin was just everything evil. There's actually, so our distillery now sits on Gin Lane in Montpelier. Part of the reason why we called it Gin Lane was a famous piece of artwork by William Hogarth, which is, there's two pieces. One is Beer Street and one is Gin Lane. And Gin Lane is just everything's in ruins. There's just all sorts of chaos in the streets and society is essentially collapsed. Whereas Beer Street is, commerce booming up and down the street and the community is working. Gin was just really painted as this like evil beverage. And because it was outlawed and folks really wanted to drink gin, people would actually barricade themselves inside of buildings and they'd hang this black plaque of a cat. And that was kind of a secret code for we've got gin here. And there would literally be coin slots in the wall and tubes, and you put in a coin, and a shot of gin would come out of the tube.
Oh, I love that. I'd love to get one installed right here, right now. Get a shot of Tomcat gin from Bar Hill. All right. You've recently, very recently, received an extremely high honor for the Bar Hill gin. It's a Nadia Comaneci performance, if you will. So tell us about it, what you just found out about Bar Hill gin.
Yeah, so this is really kind of hot off the press. Just yesterday, there's a lot of spirit competitions, and we enter some of them, and we've had pretty good luck with them. Yesterday, we got the results from the USA Spirits Award that Bar Hill gin received a 100-point score, which is definitely, the team is still kind of celebrating that moment. That's we've never had a we've had a couple of, 90 to 96 range, which has been such a great honor. But receiving a 100-point score yesterday is, it's definitely a moment we're going to hold on to for a while.
That is absolutely outstanding. I'm going to guess it's on a 100-point scale. But even if it isn't, I don't think anyone else received 100 ever. Hence the Nadia Comaneci reference when she got a 10 in the Olympics. And I think you also won a number of other honors at the U.S. Spirits as well, right?
Yeah, we did. We won Distillery of the Year, Gin Producer of the Year. It was a pretty exciting. It was a good start to the week yesterday, hearing that news.
That is absolutely phenomenal. You're listening to an encore interview with Ryan Christensen of Caledonia Spirits in Montpelier. Let's take a break and hear the rest of Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV.
Warren Village is a picture-perfect snow globe this time of year. We invite you to visit us at the almost world-famous Warren store. Come for breakfast, lunch, or après-ski. Have a signature deli sandwich, a hearty soup, or a specialty coffee drink paired with a sweet treat from our incredible bakery. Upstairs is a cornucopia of delightful and unique finds from men's, women's, and children's clothing to gifts, toys, games, jewelry, hats, gloves, and scarves. Best one-stop shopping in Vermont, according to Yankee Magazine. Fun, funky, safe, and friendly. Warren Store, Main Street, Warren Village, and warrenstore.com.
Welcome back to Vermont Viewpoint. I'm Rick Sengary. Today is Beer and Spirits Day, and we're listening to our interview with Ryan Christensen of Caledonia Spirits on this encore edition of Vermont Viewpoint. I want to know, what was your entree into distilling? How did you get into this business?
Yeah, so I like many Vermonters, I got involved in the commercial beverage space through homebrewing. You know, I started homebrewing actually when I was living in Burlington, going to Champlain College, and really just enjoyed the hobby, and eventually moved back closer to where I grew up. Here in Central Vermont, and bought a small house way out in the woods, and let homebrewing kind of consume my life for a while, and then eventually opened up a small homebrewing store. And that was all supposed to be the path to opening a commercial brewery. But when I met Todd, it was just, I was kind of mesmerized by his just love for agriculture, his ability to communicate with farmers and see the perspective of a farmer and really see, distillation as really this opportunity to add value to agriculture. And that's really how I was looking at fermentation at the time. I was not only making beer, but wine and cider and kombucha and kimchi, and really fermentation and distillation are both just means to preserve an agricultural crop. And it's become increasingly clear, particularly as I started to get to know Todd and as Caledonia Spirits has grown, that distillation provides an enormous opportunity for agriculture. There's just so much that can be grown here, but how do you actually convert that into a product that can sell at a global level? And distillation seems to let me.
Yeah. Ryan, explain the difference between the way you use honey and the production of your gin and your vodka.
So in vodka, we're fermenting it, right? So we're essentially making mead or making honey wine. We're taking multiple drums of raw honey, fresh from the apiary. We're diluting it with water, and then we're adding yeast, and then the yeast is consuming the sugar, producing alcohol, and then the still, our pot still, is then stripping that alcohol, from the wine, and in the case of vodka, you need to distill it to 95% alcohol, 190 proof. So we do two distillation runs in order to get it to that level of purity, and then we just take it from 190 proof, we proof it down to 80 by adding RO water, reverse osmosis water, and then it's ready for the bottle. Whereas with gin is all about botanicals. So we're extracting in our botanical extraction, so we're focusing on the extraction of juniper. And then the raw honey is actually a sweetener that's added to the end. But what we've really realized with honey is that there's so much more than just sugar that comes with it. There's such a brilliant botanical profile that travels with the honey that in some ways, it creates a production challenge, right? Keeping a consistent product going to market without knowing exactly what the bees have been doing. But that's where a lot of the kind of continued learning goes for our team. Every single day, we're looking at why does this honey taste different than this honey? And can we track this back to the farm and learn more about what's really going on out there?
I'm going to turn from honey to burdock root. Gobo is a spirit that Caledonia Spirits produces with burdock root. And tell us how that came about.
Yeah, Govo, that's really another accident as well, or at least just a wild experiment. I grew up in Plainfield, Vermont, and you know, Richard and Sally, the Cape Farm, I mean, they're kind of agricultural superheroes in my book. Mm-hmm. And so Sally actually called us one day and said, hey, we've got a lot of burdock. We've got some leftovers. You know, there's a lot of carbohydrate here. Would you guys ever contemplate distilling it? And to be honest, I think my response was, that sounds like a terrible idea. Not that that ever tastes good. But we do have a small lab, and we do have some small equipment. So I called Josh Pitts, who works in our lab, and he's just got an incredibly, brilliant mind for fermenting challenging things. And I said, Josh, what do you think about this project? And I think his response was the same as mine. I think he said, that sounds like a terrible idea, but we can give it a shot. And just right away, we distilled this batch, and the flavors were just incredible. You know, it's like, it's hard to really describe it without pouring it, but, you know, it had this, like, kind of earthy, oily kind of characteristic that you'd find in something more like agave-based, like a tequila or a mezcal, but grown here in Vermont and, you know, from a weed like burdock. It was just kind of this this moment where we all looked around. Our plan was to distill it to neutral. We were going to distill all flavor out of it and then make it into gin. That was why we said, yes, we'd do this. Huh. But in the process of taking it to neutral, instead of sort of trying to remove the awful flavors, we said, these aren't awful flavors at all. In fact, they're flavors that we've never really found up here. So suddenly we changed the plan. We said, forget about gin with this product, and let's make it something of its own.
It's interesting. Richard dropped off some burdock root for me, and as I smelled it, I used the same word, earthy, to describe it in a very positive way. You know, it's really kind of a beautiful smell and flavor to it. But with the Govo spirit, what would you serve it with?
Well, you can drink it on its own. You know, it's definitely a spirit that it's not instantly lovable for everyone. You know, it's definitely a very interesting flavor, similar to burdock. It works really well in tequila drinks. You know, bartenders on at the distillery have had a lot of fun, you know, swapping it out with kind of classic and fun tequila drinks. I drink it as it is. You know, I as a distiller, we would love to work with agave. But as Vermonters, we just don't feel like that's really an appropriate thing to do, to ship agave all the way up here. And we've got so much, life, right here in Vermont. So we're sipping it mostly just as it is.
Love it. Burdock root, Vermont's agave. Not sure if that's going to catch on, Ryan, but it's worth a try, right?
Works for us.
Now, one thing you've been doing there at Caledonia Spirits is you've been making hand sanitizer. So tell us how that all came about.
Yeah. So, I mean, obviously, 2020 has been quite a year to do anything. But specifically running a business has been challenging. But back in March, when the pandemic hit, the first conversations about hand sanitizer started with, there was a shortage of hand sanitizer, and there's a lot of focus on, don't touch your face, wash your hands. And we knew we just had a lot of uncertainty, and we didn't know what was going to happen. So we called a team meeting, and we actually did a build-your-own hand sanitizer workshop in the lab. And that was kind of fun, but it was such an uncertain time. I don't know how much fun we were really able to have. But then, the situation just got much more serious, and we had to shut down. We had to shut down our front of house operations, and then we started to find out that hospitals and first responders didn't have hand sanitizer, and it became this moment of, well, we can make it. We just did make it. Maybe we should. Mm-hmm. We didn't know if that was compliant, and then suddenly, both the FDA, the TTB, and the World Health Organization all started working together and moving basically at light speed, which is, those are three organizations that don't usually move very quickly at all. And basically clearing out any rules and regs that would prevent us from making hand sanitizer. And that's when it really hit that, we not only can, we need to. But What quickly became an issue was finding the raw materials to make hand sanitizer. But if anybody has been to our distillery in Montpelier, we have this big, giant copper still. Her name is Phyllis, and it's a 500-gallon, 45-plate German-made copper still that it can make a lot of 190-proof ethanol, which is what you need to make hand sanitizer. So while most distilleries were looking to buy that because it's very cheap, it ran out. And we said, well, we can actually make it ourselves. And but we teamed up with our friends up at Aquavite, Jack Weaver and team, and they had what we would describe as leftover alcohol from the kombucha process. So and then they also partnered with Feral Distributing, who had a lot of beer kegs that didn't go to the restaurants and bars. So we took beer kegs and kombucha. We sent it up to Jeff Lieber's, where they have a small scale into 190 proof, and then we made the hand sanitizer on site. And then we sent it up to the Run Amok Maple team, Eric Sorkin. They have a very powerful bottling line up there. And in the course of about 30 to 60 days, we kind of turned on a dime, and suddenly, and over the course of the summer, we put out 800,000 bottles of hand sanitizer.
Wow. That is phenomenal. Well, Ryan Christensen, he is president and head distiller of Caledonia Spirits. I want to thank you. I also want to congratulate you for the 100 score for the Bar Hill Gin. Well deserved. Thanks for being on Vermont Viewpoint this morning.
Thank you, Rick.
That was Ryan Christensen, the president and head distiller of Caledonia Spirits, on this best of version of Vermont Viewpoint. We're going to take a break for news, and then we'll be back and hear from Evan Vicar of Nano Brewery Green Empire Brewing in Colchester. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV.
Warren Village is a picture-perfect snow globe this time of year. We invite you to visit us at the almost world-famous Warren store. Come for breakfast, lunch, or après-ski. Have a signature deli sandwich, a hearty soup, or a specialty coffee drink paired with a sweet treat from our incredible bakery. Upstairs is a cornucopia of delightful and unique finds, from men's, women's, and children's clothing to gifts, toys, games, jewelry, hats, gloves, and scarves. Best one-stop shopping in Vermont, according to Yankee Magazine. Fun, funky, safe, and friendly. Warren Store, Main Street, Warren Village, and warrenstore.com.
Welcome back to Vermont Viewpoint. I'm Rick Sengary. Next up on this Beer and Spirits Encore show is Green Empire Brewing, a growing Dano brewery based in Colchester in 40th and Allen. In June, I got to speak with one of the founders and owners, Evan Vicar. Let's listen to this encore version of my interview with Evan. We've got some incredible industries that bring visitors to Vermont, and I could run down the list, but I'm just going to circle one right now, and that's craft beer. Some were here early and are gone, like Catamount and Gold Dome and Cross. Others have been around for a good long time, like Otter Creek and Long Trail. And then we had another wave, and I'm going to say this is about a decade ago this started, and it hasn't really ended. Started by The Alchemist and Lawson's Finest, Hill Farmstead, Four Quarters, and many others. There's one that in this recent wave of breweries started very small as a nano brewery, and it just keeps growing. It's Green Empire Brewing, based in Colchester at 40th and Allen. And with me to tell the story and talk about their beers is one of the founders and owner, Evan Vicar. Evan, welcome to Vermont Viewpoint.
Hey, great to be here, Rick. I appreciate you having me.
Evan, when did you start brewing beer?
So we started about 5 years ago, just on the porch, thirsty to get after that home brew. And, I guess we all started with a Heady Topper clone kit.
Right.
We were brewing in Plattsburgh, New York, and we kept driving over to Vermont to get the infamous Heady Topper even lined up, and would get a case and drive back to Plattsburgh. And, we knew we wanted to make it on our own. We started on the porch, a few friends, and it's, the excitement grew and grew.
Well, how were those early attempts at doing your own Heady?
They were decent. We called it a Heady Tapper.
Nice. Good
name.
Yeah,
it was, we had it on tap. So, right away we started putting the beer in keg, and, we skipped over the whole bottling and bottle conditioning that many home brewers do. And, we found good success in that. But, Yeah, everybody would drink free and they would let us know. But in the beginning, it was everybody was very vague with, you know, hey, is it good? They said, well, it's all there, you know, it's getting there, it's something.
You made a valiant effort early on. Then you decide to make that jump though. From homebrew to a commercial nano brewery. So what was it? What was the impetus? How did you go about from one to the other?
So I guess what really drove us was just pure excitement. And we started buying more and more equipment, more glass carboys, plastic carboys, you know, anything mm-hmm. we could ferment in, even a plastic bucket, and just started getting after it. And, you know, we even had a point, I remember brewing in an apartment on the second level, you know, we're running hoses down to the parking lot from the sink and brewing, you know, driving the neighbors crazy. And then that's when we knew we needed to shift things and started brewing more seriously in a garage space with other home brewers. And yeah, the excitement took over, and then we said, hey, well, we got a few $1,000 in this, so we might as well keep going with it, you know, naive to the legal troubles, the financial burden, and, yeah, just the tremendous stress to get a legal brewery off the ground.
Yeah, it takes a lot, and we'll talk about that. What year did you officially become Green Empire Brewing?
So, yeah, officially legally it was about 2016, and, yeah, we went around talking to other breweries and getting their 2 cents, you know, what it would cost, how long it would take, and pretty much everybody told us, whatever you're thinking you want to spend, however long you think it's going to take, just triple that.
Mm-hmm.
And, I mean, that was pretty much spot on. And it took, you know, over a year of licensing and yep. paying for water permits and
yeah, you
manufacturing
hear this from
permits, all that.
So many breweries that have plans to get started, they'll have a start date, and, yeah, you can usually add about 6 months to that before they get up and running. Now, you started as a nano brewery. We hear a lot about microbreweries, but what is a nano brewery?
So a nano brewery is, it's 3 barrels in size or less is the brewing system, which is about 150 gallons. And we started out that way, and we had a brew system that was crafted for nano brewers, so it was, you know, effectively two and a half barrel brew system. So it was really a 4-5 barrel brew house put together, you know, just side by side, so you could do 2 different batches or pilot a small batch of 100 gallons and scale it up to 200. And we, yeah, we made our start like that, and yeah, found great success with some of our IPAs, you know, side business in particular.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, and then eventually, pre-pandemic, we had plans to get a 10-barrel system, so a 300-gallon system. And we already paid for most of it come January, February, and then, COVID hit, and we kind of just went forward with it, and we're, you know, expanding and putting our new system online in March and April. The pandemic was in full swing.
So you're now a microbrewery. How many – you have the 10-barrel system now?
Correct, yep.
All right. Where'd the name Green Empire Brewing come from?
So we kind of mashed up Vermont and New York, so the Green Mountain State meets the Empire State, and, yeah, we found it was a strong name and the blending of cultures. And, yeah, since I'm from New York, you know, upstate New York, and we loved it here, went over to college in Plattsburgh, stayed there for a bit, and, eventually moved here, you know, after the love of beer took us here.
Yeah, I love that. And you started with, I think, 1 garage bay. And, you know, where are you now?
We have about 3 garage bays, roughly 2,000 square feet of manufacturing space. Well, a little less where all the fermenters are. And we have roughly 60 barrels in our little barrel room, ranging from gin, whiskey, rum, Chardonnay, Cabernet, all sorts of different barrels holding liquids
for aging. Mm-hmm. So let's talk about, you mentioned side business. What were some of those first beers that you brewed when you got started in 2016?
Yeah, so the first ones we were piloting were the side business, our Free Spirit, the Double IPA, the Chill Session, our Hemp Ale, and Leo, Beer for My Son, IPA. And those were definitely big hits. You know, we had some other ones that people weren't as excited about. And then, when we started canning, that's when we really took off, and just with side business. I mean, for 6 months straight, we only canned side business. And, you know, we're thankful to have Ironheart Canning coming in as a mobile cannery, and they just canned for us. So,
now, how often will they show up and do canning for you?
It's once a week currently, but we were doing it once a month just to get started, and just one or two tanks, you know, depending. Now it's between 3 and 5 10-barrel tanks every week at this point.
Now, Evan, we're going to talk about a lot of your different beers, but you mentioned Leo for your son, and he's a wee bairn, so I do think that takes some explanation to make sure that people didn't misinterpret that you're brewing this beer for your son to drink. So explain what Leo is and why it's named for Leo and the can, which has some beautiful art.
Yeah, so Leo has a lot of heart, and he was born, you know, right away. We found out he has Down syndrome, and he had a few holes in his heart, and so we had his heart scanned, and those images kind of lay on the back of the can, and then there's a whole astrological element with the Leo sign and his astrological sign of, I believe it's Libra in September, and then we have his heartbeat on there, and then there's the Eye of the Tiger since he's a fighter, but I'm sure he won't remember any of these surgeries and stuff, but he's good to go now, and, you know, he's 4 years old, and we started with the 2-year-old picture on the can, and then, you know, every year on his birthday in September, we update the image, and so you kind of see it age, but, you know, by the time he's 21 of good drinking age, hopefully he's helping out at the brewery, you know, he'll be able to try it out with the 20-year-old picture on there.
Yeah, that'd be fantastic.
Let's take a break, and then we'll return to hear more of my June interview with Evan Vicar. We're not taking phone calls during this segment. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV. Welcome back to Vermont Viewpoint. I'm Rick Sengary. And we're listening back to an interview with Evan Vicar of Green Empire Brewing in Colchester, recorded earlier this year.
Evan, what typifies the beers brewed by Green Empire?
Well, I think we give it a certain element of, I guess we're just very aggressive with our, you know, our water treatment, our hop treatment, and the way we do things here. I think that the nose knows now, and you're not just drinking with your mouth anymore. It's a whole sensory experience. So, you know, people are seeking a hazy beer, you know, that you can't see your fingers through it, and they want it to, you know, as it approaches their mouth, to get a very nice nose and aroma, and, you know, and then you're going for the taste. So it's a whole, you know, it's a whole sensory experience. And I think with our aggressive hop treatment, you know, it stands out, and then our artwork, of course, I think is next level. We have a great guy working for us, Sean Rice, and he makes some exquisite labels, you know, that are very well thought out, and layers of images to really stand out on the shelf with all these new breweries and a lot of competition now.
One of your early ones, was it Chill Session, used hemp in the process. Are you still doing that?
Yeah, we are. It's a much more limited batch, and it is one of our most unique. And we'd begun with, since COVID hit, we couldn't do our normal keg release that we do for 420. So we decided to age some of that in different Chardonnay barrels and Cab Sav barrels, and it's very, very exquisite. I think it's going to be a big hit. You'll see it here in the summer soon when we release it, pull it out of the Chardonnay barrels, but it gives it a different element, and I think it combines both wine and beer notes, and I think it could even be a gateway beer, if you will, for those Chardonnay drinkers or the strictly wine drinkers. So stay tuned.
Now, you've had a series over the last several years you call Working Title. I think it's made it up to number 11. First of all, what is the series all about?
So it's all about experimenting with different hops, different water profile treatments, different yeast, different malts we use, and kind of just experimenting and not totally committing the cost of a total new label to it. And really, it's allowed us to create some of our more popular brands now. From, you know, Working Title 3 became a newer double IPA, and, you know, 6 was blent with 1. And I think this 11 has been a big hit for this 90-degree weather we've been having at 6%. And, just some new hops we like to try out, or even local hops, or whatever we're feeling excited about, you know, we get to try it in the Working Title. And I know you enjoy it as well.
I do indeed. I've had all 11, and I really do enjoy it. As a matter of fact, I want to let you know, this is passing along from friends who I've had sample number 11. They say you need to add that to your regular lineup, so keep that in mind.
Cheers. We appreciate that.
All right. You've done some other things, though. We've talked a lot about IPAs, but that's just part of your lineup, right? You've done stouts. You've put in things like chocolate chips and peanuts or peanut butter.
Yeah, exactly. Your only limit is your creativity. So we've put in, you know, cosmic brownies, cacao nibs, coffees, marshmallow, peanut butter powder, you know, whatever you're thinking, we put it in a stout, and it's done really well after it's come out of a barrel, and, you know, has reached about 10 to 11%. We think favors with those adjuncts. So the adjunct stouts have been pretty popular for us. And we also do Pilsner. We've gotten really good at the Pilsner lately, and we just released our first sour this summer that's been a huge hit as well, and we're going to continue the sour.
Called Run Club. Well done there. You know, it's a pretty crowded market right now with Vermont microbreweries. So how do you sell and distribute your beer?
Well, there's always room for good beer, and I think our labels really stand above and beyond for people who haven't tried our stuff before, but just a good product, you know, people are always going to gravitate towards that. And, you know, we're distributed all the way throughout Vermont and a number of neighboring states now, and even over to Chicago, Illinois. But really, we gain a lot of new customers down at the Burlington Farmers Market every Saturday.
Mm-hmm. Did the pandemic have any effect on sales for Green Empire?
Yes, it did. We were quenching people's thirst. People have been very thirsty ever since the start of the pandemic. So, our sales have gone up, and it's just been a challenge to keep up. You know, it's been a battle to keep up and get everything in cans, and a lot have switched away from kegs and gone to cans, but it's good to be sending a lot of kegs out now to bars and see the normalcy coming back. We were worried when March hit and we had a canning run scheduled, and, you know, a lot of sleepless nights kind of waiting for what was to come next. But, you know, Ironheart Canning had our back, and we just kept trucking right along, and the governor opened up home delivery, so that was great as well. And, a lot of people benefited from that, and so did we. So trying to keep our heads straight has been, you know, has been the battle through all this. And, running helps, that's for sure.
Yeah. Does home delivery continue now that we're at 80%, the emergency, state of emergency is over?
Yes, I believe that it It does, and I know other companies are still doing it, but we have seen that slow down, so it's another good sign that things are returning, you know, back to normal. I know a lot of people have really loved the home delivery, especially if they're still working at home or continue working at home. And yeah, I believe those to-go cocktails, I think the governor has talked about continuing that since people have found great comfort in those.
Evan, we have about just about a minute left, but you've gone from nano to micro brewery, but you don't really have a tasting room or bar like a lot will have kind of at this juncture. Is that holding you back from further growth? Is that in your plans for the future?
Yes, it is in the plans. I don't believe it's quite in the cards now, but it definitely is, it is something we are thinking about. And just have to let things happen organically as they are. And, we look forward to doing more sampling out of our current place. And not quite a pseudo bar and, where we can serve pints and whatever. But right. I think just, not getting overextended and letting things happen organically is the way we should do it.
All right. In 10 seconds, what's brewing right now at Green Empire Brewing?
We're brewing some Side Drop, a collaboration with Upper Pass Brewing Company.
Nice stuff.
It's a double IPA. Yeah, we're excited about it.
Evan Vicar is founder and owner of Green Empire Brewing in 40th and Allen in Colchester. You can learn more about what they're brewing at gebrew.com. Evan, thanks for being on the show this morning.
Hey, thank you, Rick. I appreciate it.
That was from an interview recorded in June with Evan Vicar, one of the founders and owners of Green Empire Brewing in 40th and Allen. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV.
This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV. Jesse Cronin is the owner and brewer of Lucy and Howe Brewing, and I got to speak with him in July. Let's listen to this encore interview, and please note, we are not taking calls at this time. Folks at the Jericho Farmers Market had an early in on this beer, and subscribers to the Jericho Front Porch Forum also know when they can pull into Jesse Cronin's driveway for some freshly brewed IPAs, stouts, and sour ales. Luckily, I have a friend in Jericho who would forward me those notices so I could hop onto the Lucy and Howe Brewery website and get an order in and pop over on my way home on Fridays to pick up some 4-packs of Our Impossible Ask or Meal Ticket or Weeping Over the Unicorn. It's time to learn about the quirkily named brewery and its quirkier named beers. I tell you, I have not had one this morning. Jesse Cronin, owner and brewer of Lucy and Howe Brewing, is our guest. Jesse, welcome to Vermont Viewpoint.
Oh, thank you very much, Rick. Appreciate it.
I know it's not you, Jesse, but give us a little tour. Take us around your brewery there.
Well, it's a very small space. That's always the joke when people come by. They ask for a tour, and you can basically just stand in the tap room. Like, I use that word loosely.
Right.
Just stand right in the doorway and turn your head from left to right, and that's basically it. I have kind of taken over an old summer kitchen that is attached to but separately accessible from my house. It's a small barrel and a half system, which works out to be about 45 gallons. I have 2 3-barrel fermenters, which works out to about 90 gallons. And I brew at this point once a week, twice a week, two times into one tank. And I produce probably anywhere between 20 and 24 cases at a time.
Wow.
They're a super small operation. It's very hand-built, hand-crafted, I guess is the kind way of putting it. It's a lot of kind of cast-off materials that I've managed to cobble together into a working system. So
it's just off of Route 15 in Jericho. The name Lucy and Howe Brewing, where'd that come? What's that all about?
We live in an 1850s farm, like Italian Renaissance style house, I guess. It was one of the first houses on the street. And it was built by a man named Lucien Howe, who also owned his father Frank, the Red Mill in Tin Town. And they were the ones who kind of modernized the mill, turned into a 6-roller system. And the house itself is kind of a, you know, you see them all over Vermont. It's been packed onto year after year for the past 150 or so. And I was telling my daughter, who was 4 at the time, about this and how Lucy and Hal did this and Lucy and Hal made the mill and Lucy and Hal built our house. And she, for probably 10 or 15 minutes, was like, well, it's nice there was a team. I wasn't following. I don't know. What do you mean there were two of them? So I was telling the story of Lucy and Hal, who had put the house together, and she was hearing the story of Lucy and Hal. Lucy, the crack 1850s carpenter.
And thus the brewery's been named. What is your background, Jesse, in brewing?
I started home brewing almost 2 decades ago. I'm originally am a teacher, so my wife and I were teaching overseas in Austria, in Vienna, Austria, and I kind of picked it up there, mostly because at the time, the brewing history in European countries is just wide and deep, right? Mm-hmm. There's a lot of different types. There's a whole social construct piece to it, and it was something that was immediately appealing. So I started homebrewing there. We moved back to the U.S., and I was kind of faced with a choice whether I wanted to continue teaching or do something else. I stayed home with both of our kids were little, and when they went off to school, I found I had a lot of extra time on my hands. So I started working at Magic Mat, filling kegs. And working at Magic Hat full time, filling kegs, and working at Four Quarters Brewing in Winooski, just kind of doing whatever it is that Brian needed me to do for a while. And then as I worked my way up on the ladder of Magic Hat, I wound up finishing off my career there as one of the head brewers in charge of fermentation and wort production.
Wow. So what made you decide to open your own nano brewery, especially during the pandemic?
Well,
remember?
oversized sense of confidence. Maybe it was, I'd been kind of kicking the idea around because working at Magic Hat was an intensely valuable experience, but it was a very different focus. They're a national chain. The things that I learned how to do there have been immensely valuable. It's hard to brew the same batch of beer over and over again, so that whenever the customer opens up a bottle of number 9, that it tastes the same as the last time they remember drinking a bottle of number 9. Mm-hmm. So there were pieces of that that were very valuable. As far as doing my own thing and opening up a nano brewery, the size of it was manageable. So that was important. It allowed me to be at home more, which was also important. And I like being able to have a wider variety of beers. I mean, the ones that you named at the top of the program, I mean, it's a double IPA and it's a British pub ale and a milk stout. I mean, there's a lot of variety that I'm able to do. So that was important to me. As far as the pandemic, that, I was planning on opening this past winter. I had no plans of opening, you know, starting last March, but best laid plans fall by the wayside, especially when the whole economy shuts down. So I left Magic Hat, mostly because the kids were no longer in school and somebody needed to be here. And my wife is a superintendent in Montpelier, and her days were not going to get any freer.
Right.
It was kind of the inverse, like with work shutting down, the demands on her time and her planning and trying to figure out how school was going to look in this unprecedented experience kind of shot up. So I just I left Magic Hat, and I luckily had almost everything in place that I needed, and I opened up May 1st, 2020.
That's fantastic. Now, I know you do have a wide variety of styles of beer, but what typifies beers made at Lucy and Howe?
Beers made at Lucy and Howe has a strong focus on quality, and independent, like individual attention. There's a benefit to being small, and then part of that benefit is every can that leaves every can that gets put into a four pack, everything that's packaged is handled by me. The quality control piece is at a level of focus I haven't been able to do in other places.
Mm.
So there's a strong focus on quality, and there's a strong focus on kind of internationally inspired ales and lagers is what the website says. So there's the beer that's out there, like I was saying before about Europe, the history and the beer territory is wide and deep. So trying to explore some of those and bring some of those to a wider market is very appealing to me.
Making beer is one side of it, Jesse. The selling of the beer is the other. So how did you go about to start selling your beer?
My wife would tell you I'm terrible at it. This is the most that I've talked about myself in one stretch for a long time. I have to lean on the support of the community here. Jericho has been amazingly receptive.
Mm-hmm.
Because there are styles that I make. I have a sea salt goza out now, learned to float. That's a real light, dry, easy drinking, and it's really good with hot weather and a river close by. But it's not a style that's typical. So the as far as the selling the beer goes, using social media, using Front Porch Forum, the market was a huge pull. And I've found that as far as the town goes, Jericho is great as far as word of mouth is concerned. Like your friend who forwarded you the announcements. That stuff is invaluable.
Warren Village is a picture-perfect snow globe this time of year. We invite you to visit us at the almost world-famous Warren store. Come for breakfast, lunch, or après-ski. Have a signature deli sandwich, a hearty soup, or a specialty coffee drink paired with a sweet treat from our incredible bakery. Upstairs is a cornucopia of delightful and unique finds from men's, women's, and children's clothing to gifts, toys, games, jewelry, hats, gloves, and scarves. Best one-stop shopping in Vermont, according to Yankee Magazine. Fun, funky, safe, and friendly. Warren Store, Main Street, Warren Village, and warrenstore.com.
We're back on Vermont Viewpoint. Let's hear the rest of our interview from July with Jesse Cronin of Lucy and Howe Brewing in Jericho.
Jesse, is there a beer that is the signature or flagship brew of Lucy and Howe?
The closest that I have come is a simple, low ABV, just bright and citrusy table beer that I call Beer Maison. And it's... I kind of get into some wilder things, but as far as beer that's out regularly and is kind of built for an everyday sort of shared beer experience, that's the flagship. It's a 4.4% Belgian style table beer, brewed with coriander and lemon. So it's bright, it's easy to drink, dry, effervescent, everything that I kind of look for in an everyday standard.
Mm-hmm. The names of the beers are incredible. So I got to know, do you keep like a little notepad and jot down some interesting phrase when you hear it? I mean, how do you go about doing that?
That's I have a long list on my phone. And for the most part, the names come from like really smart, clever things my children have said or really stupid, dumb things I have said. So that's where a bulk of them are. Shadow of a Lonely Fish, that was something my son said when we were down at the Echo looking at the aquarium and the fish swimming around. And it was just, some of that, it's like everyday poetry. It's just out there.
Yeah.
So it's fun to, especially sitting on the table with some friends. There were a couple that came out from a dinner party we had last night. It was, it was nice just to be able to chat and have these little bits of poetry pop out.
I'm pretty sure that there are going to be bands all over Vermont that are going to get in touch with you. New bands, as they form, when they need a name, they're going to call you. All right. How many different beers do you brew so far?
That's a question. I have probably out at any given time, I have four or five.
Right.
Yeah, four or five are always typically available. I do some limited distribution through Vermont Beer Shepherd, who have been amazing. So that kind of gets stuff out to local Jericho stores and places in Stowe. So they typically have one or two different brands. I mean, the library of beers I have were probably at 15 to 25, I think. I try and concentrate on the flagship, Beer Maison. I try and concentrate on having one kind of hoppy offering, because those are popular,
yes,
to say the least. And then, you know, to have two or three other kinds that are a little bit more off the beaten path, as it were.
Now, it sounds like you're having a lot of fun coming up with them. So how do you develop new beers?
It's a combination of research and personal preference and a little bit of what may or may not be out in the market currently. I focus on local ingredients as much as possible. It's a little problematic with malt sometimes. Peterson's in Charlotte is really good. Champlain Valley Hops has a nice operation. So there's, you know, as far as hops and grains, there are places to go. But I've been working with some local farmers a little bit. So, you know, it's strawberry season. So there's a strawberry beer coming out in the next couple of weeks. Sometimes I'll just be at some place like the Jericho Farmers Market. And if somebody has a really nice batch of something, there was a honey beer I made last year that kind of came out because of that. I was next door to a honey producer. Where the attorney of now, that's where that came from.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a lot of it is kind of letting the ingredients speak.
Now you're there at the house, and then you've got the brewery in the back. So how are you able to brew where you live?
It's interesting. There's a lot of kind of juggling that happens. I guess as far as brewing where I live, you can't beat the commute. That needs to be said right away. And
right.
It's nice to be able to just pour myself a cup of coffee and, you know, step outside for a minute and there we are.
Yeah.
It's really nice to be, especially when the pandemic was in full swing, it was really nice to be able to have one of the kids come and say, listen, I need help with, you know, this math. Mm. And I could take 15 minutes and, you know, do that and then, you know, get back to whatever I was doing in the brewery. So there's a lot of positives. As far as the mechanics of it, I mean, I have to be really careful. I can't tolerate too many spills. I have some people who, you know, who have chickens to feed, so they take the grain. A lot of stuff goes into compost.
Mm.
We've gotten to a manageable system after a little bit of trial and error.
All right, let's talk about some of the beers again. You mentioned how Shadow of a Lonely Fish was named, so now tell us all about that beer.
Shadow of a Lonely Fish is a 6.6, I believe, ABV Belgian stout. So that one is a little, it has a lot of characteristics of what you look for in a stout. There's strong roast character. It's a very dark beer. There's a toasty, strong malt backbone to it, understated hop usage. And then on top of that is sort of the playfulness of Belgian yeast fermentation, which, depending on what temperature you're fermenting at, can bring some kind of spicy, peppery notes. It can be a little fruity. So it's a nice combination of a kind of expected style. Stouts are pretty well known. And then combining that with a little bit of Belgian flair.
Mm. Is there a particular beer that you've been kind of chasing, one that you have kind of like the holy grail of Jesse Cronin, you know, on your list that you're trying to perfect, that you're, you know, chasing after that someday we'll have in a can and be able to drink?
There's one that I've been working on for a little while. It's a Belgian style IPA, or IPA rather. So it's that sort of combination of a New England style IPA, which is, again, like a pretty popular style. People know what kind of to expect. You know, it's got the smooth, silky sort of wheat malt backbone to it. And then on top of it are just all that playfulness from the hops. I want to have, I want to have a beer that combines those characteristics with a Belgian yeast strain. There's a fruitiness you can get from it. It's just, it's slightly unusual. And it kind of, I think those elements play well together. Schilling has one that's out. It's delicious. But that's, you know, I have one batch in cans, but it's not quite, it's named something else now. We missed the target a little bit, but still good, but not what I wanted.
Now, I listened to a Scottish band called Penguins Kill Polar Bears. Of course, I listened to a band, from Scotland called Penguins Kill Polar Bears. What would I be drinking if I pop off one of your Penguins at the Rock show while listening to my band?
That's probably the best pairing I've heard of so far. That's amazing. So if you popped open a can of Penguins at the Rock show, you would be drinking an American pale ale. The beer was designed to have a lot of the elements of a New England hazy IPA. It was designed to have that kind of smooth body. It was designed to have those tropical hoppy notes. But it was designed to have a much lower ABV point because I'm older now. And as much as I love some of the really heavy-duty IPAs, I can't have them as often as I once could, let's say. So it's 5.5%. It's a slightly lighter beer. It's a nice and manageable ABV, and it still delivers that kind of hoppy, tropical experience.
My favorite of yours is Our Impossible Ask, which is not an easy one to say, but tell people about that.
That one was born of the pandemic. That was, there was a point, it was probably halfway through, maybe. It was sometime in the fall, so not quite that far. But it was just seeing what was happening with the school systems and the things they were being asked to do. To completely pivot on from and completely turn around their entire like instruction delivery model and still provide, you know, academic support to a community that is now in the throes of this really kind of nebulous unknown, and trying to get through it themselves. It was a lot, and it was, you know, I have a lot of respect for anybody who managed to kind of answer the call in that way. But, you know, having been a teacher and being married to a person in the education, profession, I felt I owed them a drink. So I brewed up Our Impossible Ask, which is, 7.7%, double IPA. So it's like Penguins, but just amped up to that higher ABV.
It sure is. We got about a minute and a half left. First of all, Jesse, what is it that you enjoy most about running your own nano brewery?
It's funny. That's the positive. The thing I like the most and the thing I like the least are kind of entwined. I'm the one that I answer to. So there's a lot of freedom and there's a lot of ability to do what I feel needs to be done. But I'm the one making all of the choices. So there's nobody else to blame when it goes south.
And a year in, plans to expand. Where are you going from here?
Oh, that's a good question. I think, there's definitely plans. I'm taking it slow. So far the growth has been fairly organic. It's, I have a community focus. I really appreciate the support that Jericho has given and Underhill and Essex and the surrounding towns. So we're mulling over a couple of different expansion plans. We'll kind of see what takes shape over the next year.
That's exciting. Jesse Cronin is the owner and brewer at the Jericho Nano Brewery, Lucy and Howe Brewing, and their website address is lucyandhowebrewing.com. Jesse, you did great. Thanks so much for being with us, telling us all about your venture. It is delicious. Thanks.
Well, thank you very much, Rick. I appreciate the time.
That was Jesse Cronin, owner and brewer of Lucy Howe Brewing in Jericho. Our last stop this morning as we sample Vermont-made beer and spirits is in Windsor, where we'll hear an interview that aired in April when we spoke with the owners of Silo Distillery, Anne-Marie Delaney and Peter Gilson. This is an encore edition of Vermont Viewpoint, so we're not able to take your phone calls. Thanks for understanding.
One of the cool places you can stop into when you're in the Windsor area is the Silo Distillery Barn, where, believe it or not, one of the things they make is a lemon-flavored vodka. Ah, but oh, so much more. We're going to learn the Silo story and taste as best we can over the air, some of the wonderful spirits they're creating there. Joining me to tell us all about it are the owners of Silo Distillery. We have Anne-Marie Delaney. Good morning, Anne-Marie.
How are you this morning?
I'm wonderful. And Peter Gilson. Peter, thank you for being here.
Good morning, Rick. Pleasure to be here.
Oh, it's great to have you both. All right. We'll start with, where did you start? Where did the idea for Silo come from? Anne-Marie?
It was really Peter's idea.
Oh, okay.
And I just got involved. Let Peter cover that, and then I'll tell you kind of how I sort of flowed into it.
All right, that sounds great.
I think, Rick, that Emery is being a little being involved. She'll explain what the level of involvement is. But to answer your question, we started back in 2012. Mm-hmm. I started writing my life prior to the distillery was I was. I'm an eighth-generation Vermonter, but I had been in the medical industry for 30-plus years, extensive travel, tried to get back to Vermont on weekends as best I could, and ultimately wanted to make the decision, you know, somehow to get back here. So it was an exit strategy, in a way, of starting up the distillery. Sat down, wrote the business plan on weekends when I had time, then I'd head out and do my other day job, and we managed to gather some investors together. We had a partnership with Cornell University and Michigan State, who are two of the academic sort of experts out there in the world of distilling. And we managed to get introduced to a company called Carl out of Germany, and they are world-renowned. They've been making copper stills for forever, and they are the experts. And that's sort of how everything began. We found, through an introduction, a guy by the name of George Abetti, who owns a company called Geo Barns, and George built the barn sort of around the specifications that we needed for, you know, housing the production equipment, and we were sort of off and running.
Well, I'm dying to find out how Anne-Marie came in from Ireland into all of this.
I actually have been here for a long time. I arrived in Cincinnati and then arrived on the, made our way to New Hampshire in my previous life, and then back to Boston, which I loved, and came when Peter came up with this idea. We always had the house here, and we were living in Boston, and so we ended up living here permanently in Barnard. But the best part of it was when Peter came up with the idea, I realized that one of the things that I loved to do was to design and plan. And so when the barn idea came in to play, I got to work with David Hamilton, who's part of the Geo Barns business, and he's their architect. And so I was working on how to design, where to put the barn, which ended up being in Artisan Park in Windsor. It was a great place to be. It had Harpoon and Simon Pierce in the behind us, so we were the filling to the sandwich, and it went from there. But I got to sort of design the tasting room, and Peter got to do the kind of production area. So that kind of worked very nicely for both of us.
Well, we've talked about the barn. Go ahead.
No, he hates doing what I do, and I hate doing what he does. So it's kind of a nice balance to work it out.
Oh, that's wonderful. Well, we keep talking about the barn, so somebody describe it for our listeners so they know what this wonderful space is all about.
Yeah, so I can do that. So it's we painted it red. It's a wooden structure that looks exactly like a barn. We included a silo in the barn design, because we're calling the business Silo. Mm-hmm. And it has a downstairs space and an upstairs area where you can have cocktails. Not recently, mind you, but normally. And two bars downstairs. And we added a patio 2 years after we opened where people can sit outside when the weather permits, and we have parties there, and people come and taste. And the one good thing is we incorporated big windows that you can see from one space to the other. So it's well worth coming just to visit
right.
the beautiful car and equipment that Peter talked about, and to have a cocktail or a taste or just see the space that's so beautiful. It's a nice place to visit.
It absolutely is. And, Peter, we're going to talk about how much the line has expanded there at Silo Distillery. But what was the initial spirit or spirits that you start to make at Silo?
Yeah, Rick, like most craft distillers, you start out typically with a vodka. And the reason for that is that in the manufacturing process, making a bottle of vodka is about 7 days from field to bottle. So we source all of our grain from a farm called the Grembowitz Farm in North Clarendon. From the time that we actually get the grain delivered in 50-pound bags into the distillery, we can have a filled bottle of vodka in 7 days. And, you know, that's tied into the need to, you know, obviously when you've invested as much money and time into getting things up and running, you want to get out the door as fast as you can. So that was a way that we could start generating some revenue. And we've expanded that line now from the original vodka to gin. We have a cucumber, lemon vodka, as you mentioned before, lavender vodka, and we also do whiskeys. And the whiskeys have been a later stage addition to our product line because we had to wait for, you know, the maturity in the barrels, and, you know, it takes time to generate enough of a secure cash base so that you can wait for that product to be ready to sell.
Now, I'm assuming that Silo, the name, came first, and that kind of then, you know, created the barn idea with the Silo. Am I right about that? Where did the name come from?
The idea was, When Peter talks about it's basically field to barn to mm-hmm. bottle, so we wanted the business we started thinking, what can we do in Vermont and what's available in Vermont that we can use, and once we identified grains as being very available and extremely well grown, and the land lends itself to that, we decided that we would come up with a name that we didn't actually. We just, Silo just seemed to jump into our heads.
Mm.
The silo is where grains are held. It also, it feels like it's a good, we love to see a silo.
Right.
So it's visually appealing, and it's everywhere. It's on the Northeast, but it's also Midwest as well. But there's something endearing about it, and we wanted the name. We had called the business American Crafted Spirits, but we wanted something that sounded easier and that you'd remember it. And so Silo was born.
I love it.
And everything is round. the label is round.
Oh, right.
The bottle is round. So we sort of went from there.
Well, you know, Peter, as Anne-Marie had alluded to, you have this motto or directive, farm to barn to bottle, and you mentioned where you're sourcing those grains. Has that been difficult to have grains from right here in Vermont to be able to use in your products?
You know, that's a great question, Rick. And you know, going back to the beginning, you know, part of what was included in the business plan that I wrote was that I wanted to be able to source grains from a number of different farmers. And, you know, that was all about helping, you know, economic development and, you know, providing, if possible, another revenue stream for, you know, the farmers out there. And, you know, while the idea, I think, was a good one, where we ran into problems early on was, you know, the farmers, these guys work hard. And they're in the fields all day, and, you know, for them to be able to, you know, package the grain and have it, you know, delivered to us was just a burden. And there was also, you know, an issue with the quantity that we were requiring. In the beginning, you know, as we were getting off the launch pad, you know, our demand was not that great, but it's significantly ramped up. So, you know, we were always looking for, you know, a supplier that could or suppliers that could provide what we need in North Clarendon, and they supply all of our grain. And they also can and have in the past done, you know, planted wheat for us, planted rye for us. So it's been a really great relationship. And I, on average, we take in about 5 ton of grain every 3 weeks or so.
We're listening back to an interview from earlier this year when we spoke with the owners of Silo Distillery in Windsor. Let's take a break and then return for more of this best of edition of Vermont Viewpoint.
Hi, it's Tara from Green Mountain Solar. Winter is just around the corner, and most of us are dreaming of hitting the slopes, making snowmen, or, if you're like me, hibernating with a good book. But what no one is looking forward to, winter expenses. That's where solar's a smart solution. With heating costs on the rise, you can rest assured that with solar, your electric bill won't go up too. Solar will insulate you from rate hikes, offset your energy usage, and save you money. We also install heat pumps, which means you can slash both your electric bill and your heating bill. Or learn more about battery backup systems that can keep your lights on no matter what storm Old Man Winter throws at Vermont. Have questions about solar? Like, how does net metering work? What incentives are available? What about snow? Our solar advisors will answer all of it. Ask us anything. And yes, we install year-round, even in winter. To get started with solar, visit us at greenmtnsolar.com.
Hey there, I'm Lance Bass, and this is Chip. And for more than 100 years, American Humane has been protecting animals in times of crisis. And if you're like me, your pet means the world to you, and you want to keep them safe if disaster strikes. American Humane's first responders are always prepared to rescue animals in danger, but you can also help. To learn more about disaster planning and keeping your animals safe, please visit AmericanHumane.org.
Welcome back to Vermont Viewpoint. All this week, we've been sharing some of the best interviews from 2021 with you. Let's return to our interview with the owners of Windsor's Silo Distillery, Anne-Marie Delaney and Peter Gilson.
What kind of events do you hold at the distillery in a normal year?
We actually have birthday parties. Rehearsal dinners are one of the favorites. It's a lovely venue, and people like to be able to be outside and inside, and they pick specialty cocktails for their groom and the bride. And we do it in various ways. So we can have it catered. We can have a food truck. It can be formal or it can be casual. Whatever the client prefers. They can have music. They can dance. It's all there. But birthday parties, bridal showers during the daytime. It's open for a variety of events.
And is the tasting room open for visitors right now?
So, yes, our hours are reduced and have been for a while. I mean, we closed down completely until we started making hand sanitizer. But we are open primarily Friday through Sunday. Soon though, with the changes, we'll be open 7 days a week. From about noon to 5 or 6 in the evening, but COVID has shortened those hours for us. There aren't that many people around.
We will eventually all get out again. And now I had Jarvis Green of JAG Productions on the show a couple of months ago. Tell us about your JAG Ambassador Program.
So that's something that's near and dear to our hearts. Mm-hmm. I mean, we've always supported everyone. That's never been, we've never discriminated in any aspect of our business. And that then, I had known Jarvis. He had been involved in starting a Barn Arts here in Barnard. And so he and I are friends. And so that was the avenue that we used, or that we automatically became involved in when we wanted to voice our concerns about Black Lives Matter and how important it was for our business to support him in particular in every way that we could.
Now, Peter, I know you're getting excited because we still really haven't jumped into the spirits much, so I want to talk about that. We did touch on the vodkas, which include cucumber, there's lavender, cacao, and lemon. But let's talk about your gins, which, first of all, you have a reserve gin and a regular gin. What's the difference between the two?
The reserve gin, Rick, is a barrel-aged product. So it sits, and it depends on the length of time. It's all about taste, so we sample it periodically. But that's the primary difference.
And the one thing that I love so much about your gins, you use Vermont apples.
We do. We use Vermont Honeycrisp apples. It's a delicious gin. It's very... It's not a dry gin. I think it's somewhere in between, you know, sort of a Hendrix, more on the Hendrix scale of things.
Mm-hmm.
But it's been very popular since we came out with it. And again, I think we were sourcing our apples from Wellwood Farms, I believe, which is they're in Springfield or somewhere in that neck of the woods. But again, you know, another avenue of sourcing locally.
Now, you mentioned that whiskey is more of kind of a later entry for you all, but explain the whiskeys that you make.
So it depends, and one of the things that we've done over the last couple of years is we've moved a lot of the whiskey's for sale, quote unquote, to the distillery as opposed to putting it out into the state system. And a lot of the reason behind that is that we try to do some unique things, like, for example, you know, limited edition kinds of things. Right now, or as of yesterday, I think it was, there's a term called tipping a barrel, and that basically means when the spirit in the barrel that you're aging in is ready to bottle, you tip it. And I tipped a barrel of rye the other day that had been sitting for about 3 years. So that's currently available. We have a fair amount of bourbon that's in barrels that is going to be ready at various stages over the next, you know, 12 to 24 months. And we continue to make sure that we have, you know, product going into barrels so that, you know, as we're exhausting one, for example, in particular, when you're making bourbon, you need to use a white oak barrel, and you can only use the barrel once for bourbon. And so when we tip that barrel and we bottle the bourbon, we can make another whiskey. You know, we could put rye in there. We could put, wheat. We could do a number of different things, which we do. So we really get two uses out of the barrel. But we'll continue to experiment. We have a very popular maple whiskey. And again, that's all by sourcing local ingredients, the maple producers here. And it's been about 2 years now since we came out with that product, maybe longer. But it's very, very popular.
All right. There's something else. I think this is one that you do kind of just in special batches, but I do want to talk about it because I was over at friend's home maybe 2 months ago, 3 months ago. For the first time in my life, I had, I hope I get the pronunciation right, Amaro. And you do a Vermaro, which is a Vermont Amaro. So first of all, explain what an Amaro is.
So an Amaro is Italian digestive, and each almost town in Italy has a different variation of it. They use herbs and peels, and they make this incredible digestive that they serve after each meal that you have. We decided that we could make a Vermont version of that. And so our distiller at the time put together a combination of lemon and lime and grapefruit peels and botanicals, and used actually to sweeten it up our maple syrup. And we called the product Vermaro, playing on Vermont and Amaro.
Mm-hmm.
It's definitely a specialty drink. I mean, not many people know about it, but when they taste it, they love it.
I was stunned the first time I had one. I can't wait to try yours. We only have about a minute left, but one other place you've gone that I was kind of surprised and happy to see is you have your own cider.
Yes, that was I'll try to be brief, but I got a lot of pushback on that from Anne Marie and the rest of the staff. You know, they basically said to me, wait a second, what are we doing here? And I said, well, I'll tell you what we're doing. We have all the equipment. I have a very longstanding friend of the family here in Barnard, you know, going back to about 100 years, not me, but our families have you know, sort of been joined at the hip for that long a period of time. The orchard is called Moore's Orchard, and it's in North Pomfret. And so, aside from, you know, all the pushback I was getting, I said, you know, we're going to do this. We're just going to do it. And we had a taste profile that we were really interested in. The cider, when you taste it, is very much like a Prosecco, so it's on the dry side of things. Mm-hmm. And that, too, has been a hugely successful product for us. And it's a nice adjunct as well during the, you know, sort of the slower months because, mm-hmm. You know, people, particularly, you know, the unfortunate circumstances of COVID, you know, people and where they can go and what they can buy and how they buy is more, you know, tailored to, you know, going into a retail establishment, which we're pretty well, exposed across the state of Vermont at this point. But it's a great product. If you get a chance to try it, I think you'd really like it.
Way to persevere, Peter. That's Peter Gilson, Anne Marie Delaney, the owners of Silo Distillery in Windsor. Online, you can find them at silodistillery.com. It was absolutely delicious having you two tell us all about what you're doing there. Thanks so much.
Thanks, Rick. Have a great day.
You've been listening to a best-of recording of Vermont Viewpoint. That was the owners of Silo Distillery, Anne Marie Delaney and Peter Gilson. And that's our show for today. Vermont Viewpoint is directed by Danny McGivergan. Our email address is vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. Feel free to suggest topics or guests. And you can listen to past episodes of Vermont Viewpoint by downloading our podcast at wdevradio.com. The Vermont Viewpoint podcast is sponsored by the Warren Store, funky, friendly, and almost world famous. I'm Rick Singeri. Tomorrow we'll conclude our Best of Vermont Viewpoint Week when we hear from some of the WDEV All-Stars during this 90th anniversary year.